The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Finally, David Grimm, Science's online news editor, is here to fill us in on some recent stories on our daily news site. So the first story you have for us is on the origin of bedbugs. Not the most popular topic these days.
Right. Nobody likes bedbugs. And one of the biggest problems with bedbugs is they're almost impossible to get rid of. One of the common insecticides people spray is something known as pyrethroid. This is also an insecticide used against cockroaches, but it hasn't been very effective against bedbugs. That's not really what this new study is about, although this new study helps answer the question about why pyrethroids don't work on bedbugs. But the real point of this new study is, where did bedbugs come from in the first place? How did they get here, and why are they so annoying?
What did these researchers do to figure out where bedbugs came from?
Well, Sarah, what they did in this study was they actually looked at the genetics of a variety of bedbug populations across the U.S. East Coast, and they looked at something called microsatellites. And these are basically short pieces of DNA that vary between populations. They can give you a sense of the genetic diversity of a population. And that a more diverse a population is, the bigger the chance that it came from many different places. You can imagine if you looked all up and down the East Coast and all the bedbugs were highly related to each other, then they probably all came from the same place. But that's not what the researchers found here. They found that all of these populations they looked at were very different from each other, which was surprising because one of the ideas about bedbugs is they had originated in the U.S., possibly on poultry farms. That's where one of the first sightings of bedbugs were. But if they all came from the U.S. and if they all came from the same place, you'd expect them to be very similar, and they weren't. So based on this new result, the researchers are saying, well, seems like the bedbugs may be coming from a lot of different places, not just the U.S., but potentially a bunch of different places around the world.
And were they able to determine where they were coming from?
They weren't able to determine exactly where, but that's kind of where this pyrethroid resistance comes in, because it turns out that in tropical countries, people in these countries have really drastically scaled up their mosquito control, and they do this by basically putting pyrethroids on everything, spraying indoors and providing bed nets that are coated with pyrethroids. And the more of this sort of insecticide you have around, and if you've got bed bugs around too, the more likely they are to develop resistance. And so it's possible that some of them may have come from the tropics, although given the great amount of genetic diversity, they probably came from a lot of other places.
But you also say the study has something to do with why bedbugs are so annoying.
Right. And what I mean by annoying is, why do their numbers explode so rapidly? And the genetics also provide a clue to that. It turns out that even though the populations that these researchers looked at were very different genetically from each other, when they looked within populations, the bedbugs were extremely highly related. And that suggests there's a lot of inbreeding going on. And researchers already sort of suspected that bedbugs were highly inbred. You see this in other insect species as well. And because bedbugs inbreed so much, the researchers say that actually a single female brought in on a mattress or a couch could actually cause an infestation for an entire building just by herself, because she's having offspring and all these offspring are breeding with each other, and their offspring are breeding with each other, and you just have this huge population explosion. And so that, combined with the resistance to the pesticide, just makes these guys so hard to get rid of. So the new study not only tells us why they're so annoying, but also gives us a little sense of where they came from, too.
And hopefully that will contribute to eliminating them from our lives.
One would hope.
This next story is about another kind of infestation, farms infested with antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
Exactly. This next story is all about something known as antibiotic resistance, which is a real problem on livestock farms. Farmers tend to feed livestock a whole host of antibiotics, and the reason they do this is because when animals get sick, or even if they have low-lying infections, they tend to grow slower. And farmers, especially those farmers that are producing meat for the general population, want their animals to grow as fast and as big as possible. So a lot of farms load these guys up with a lot of antibiotics. But the concern comes in is because these animals are obviously part of our food chain. And if these animals harbor microbes that are resistant to antibiotics, and somehow these microbes get into us, then all of a sudden we start getting infections that are very hard to treat. And that's been a big concern. It's been hard to prove that that's actually happening, but it's been a big concern among scientists. And this new study asks the question, okay, if we take a farm and we stop treating the animals with antibiotics, will the antibiotic resistance disappear over the course of a few years?
And why do they expect the antibiotic resistance to go away?
Well, it's a good question. When these microbes develop antibiotic resistance, they usually acquire genes on small circular pieces of DNA known as plasmids. And these plasmids are separate from the bacteria's main genome. And so these plasmids are actually very energetically costly to maintain. You're spending a lot of energy replicating genes, and if you don't need to protect yourself against an antibiotic, why waste the time? And bacteria can actually very easily kick these plasmids out. So the thinking was, okay, we stop treating the livestock with antibiotics, all these plasmids get kicked out, and all of a sudden, these animals are still have bacteria, but these bacteria are no longer antibiotic resistant. At least that was the thinking, but that's not actually what the researchers showed in this new study. They looked at a Canadian pig farm, and in 2007, this pig farm had stopped treating the animals with antibiotics. And what the researchers did was, 2.5 years later, after the farm had stopped treating the animals with antibiotics, they looked through the gut microbes of these animals. They looked through the waste, actually, of the animals, and they tried to see, you know, whether the bacteria that were there were still resistant to antibiotics such as chlorotetracycline. And what they found, which is really surprising, is that most of these bacteria were still highly resistant to the antibiotics. As many as 70 to 100% of them were, depending on the sample that the researchers tested.
And did they have an idea about why that might have stuck around, the resistance might still be there?
Well, it's a good question because, you know, they would have expected that these bacteria not needing that resistance anymore would have kicked out the plasmids that contain the resistant genes. What they suspect is these plasmids don't just contain genes that help the bacteria fight antibiotics. They also contain genes that may help the bacteria do other things. Pigs on this farm are fed a lot of copper and zinc that's found in pig feed, and it's possible that the bacteria don't like this either, and perhaps they have a gene on their plasmid that helps them deal with these metals. And so it's possible that it, just as a side effect of that, they're keeping the antibiotic resistance around.
So what does the long-term presence of these resistant bacteria mean for farmers and for everybody else?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. Now that we know that this antibiotic resistance is sticking around, what does that mean for us? One of the troubling things is there's a common practice of using swine waste as fertilizer. And so can you imagine, you've got this swine waste and you think it doesn't have any antibiotic resistance in it, but it does, and you're spreading it over crops. It's getting into the water supply, potentially. What impact is that going to have on humans? Now, that's really still a black box right now. Researchers just say there's really no conclusive evidence to show that even if there is a lot of antibiotic resistance on farms, that it's actually getting into the human food supply, that it's getting into hospitals, places that could cause a lot of trouble.
This next story is on a more hopeful note, getting usable fuel from plant waste.
Right. We're still on the farm in this next story. The farm here, though, is more of an agricultural farm. And for many years, researchers have been interested in turning plants into fuel, what's called biofuels. And the idea would be that this is an alternative source of energy. And the basic idea is you take a plant and you add a bunch of enzymes or microbes to the plant material. This breaks down the plant into sugars, and the microbes convert these sugars into ethanol and potentially other fuels. And the good part is that gives us an alternative for some of the more problematic ways of creating all sorts of fuels for modern society. The problem is that these microbes don't do a very good job. It's a very expensive process. Also, a lot of the plants that are used for biofuel production right now are things like sugarcane and other important crops. And the issue is that a lot of people in the world need those crops to eat too. And so why are we using them for fuel? And they're taking up a lot of land needed for fuel. So this new study is all about, can we find a better way to convert plants into fuel? And can we use different kinds of plants like trees and grasses, which people don't eat, and even agricultural waste, and turn that into fuel?
So this sounds like a great plan. Why aren't we doing it already?
Well, the problem with these other sources of biofuel is that they're a lot harder to break down than things like sugarcane. They're a lot hardier. There's a lot more complex molecular chains going on. So the enzymes and the microbes would have to work even harder, and they're already not doing that great of a job in the first place. What this new study did to surmount that problem was it actually took these microbes, and instead of creating these expensive enzyme cocktails, it actually gave the microbes the genes that they needed to break down these really tough plants. And what they found was when they added these microbes to agricultural waste and trees and grasses and things that are traditionally hard to break down, the microbes actually did a pretty good job of it. And not only did they do that, they created things besides ethanol. They created precursors for things like gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. So a larger range of useful fuels.
Yeah, we don't see a lot of ethanol gas tanks here.
Not yet. Not yet.
So we're not using food anymore to create fuel in this plan, but are there any other downsides that come up?
Well, the enzymes and the microbes are still not working as efficiently as they could be. It's still taking them a lot of work to do this, and the amount of fuel they're generating is pretty low. So this isn't a very efficient process yet. It's not ready for prime time. But the scientists hope that this is an important first step and that this will really eventually get us to where we want to be with biofuels.
Great. And so what else is on the news site this week?
Well, Sarah, for Science Now, we've got a very interesting story about the earliest bedding ever found. Also, a few stories about new results that are coming out from the Kepler Space Telescope, new findings about extrasolar planets and alien worlds, what that means for the possibility of finding life out there elsewhere in the universe. For Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a story about how the U.S. is pouring more money into tackling rare diseases. Also, the continuing saga of Judy Mikovits, and this is the controversial researcher that has linked chronic fatigue syndrome to a mouse retrovirus. She was recently put in jail, and we are following what is going on with that story, so be sure to check that out on Science Insider. And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's topic is on the role of nanotechnology in solar energy. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
Thank you, Dave. David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog Science Insider at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.